Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. Okay, from Popular Science. Have you ever noticed why it feels different in the fall and the spring, even when the temperature is the same, like 60 degrees?
Sure, yes. Because one of them is spooky and one of them is Easter. And I mean...
Yeah, sadly, this article from Popular Science does not cover a lot of the esoterics. But we do get into two particular frameworks to explain how this difference kind of manifests in us. One is biological and the other is meteorological.
Huh.
So the meteorological reason is that when we're taking weather measurements, we usually use weather stations that are about 6 feet off the ground. What we're not taking into account with those measurements is the ground temperature. And the ground takes a while to reach temperature parity with the air. So in the summer, the ground is warm, but when we start to cool and get into cooler seasons, the ground changes temperature slower, so it stays kind of warm. And then what the ground is actually made of can also play an effect, right? So sometimes walking around the city on a fall day can actually feel warmer than doing something like hitting the pumpkin patch on Grandpa O'Leary's farm or whatever you've got in your area. They're everywhere now, right? But there's also biological reasons because we are made of meat, right? And electricity. But if you've ever heard or been guilty of saying, oh, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. Well, yes, of course, that absolutely plays a part. Just like we have dry heat that can feel more comfortable than a wet heat. Yeah, wet cold sucks. And if you can imagine wet cold versus dry cold, where it's like the cold is just seeping into your clothing and sticking to your skin. Ugh.
Yeah, versus Colorado, which is just glorious in the sun.
It's true.
Steaming in short sleeves.
Yeah. Yeah, and the humidity and probably the elevation plays a great part in that, right? This is also why we get goosebumps in the cold. The hairs on your arm act as a mesh network to trap just a tiny layer of air near your skin, almost like a little auric bubble. So if that air is humid, it's going to take a lot more energy to warm up. So it's going to pull more energy from you. And if it's pulling energy from you, it makes you feel cold. Also, the placement of our capillaries plays a role, right? The capillaries are these delicate, teeny tiny blood vessels. So during the summer or in a warm climate, capillaries are closer to the surface of the skin. That way, heat can be released more efficiently. But in the wintertime, they kind of burrow a little bit deeper. They get more insulation around them, so you're losing less heat out to the atmosphere.
Right. There's a physical acclimation, not only a mental one.
Correct. Your body actually is doing things to moderate with the temperature, and maybe your body can actually feel you're getting sensory feedback of capillaries descending, and it's just...
Just worms burrowing into your skin. That's what it feels like. Yeah.
You know? And of course, you know, there's a degree of personalization to, like, what is hot? What is cold? Right? The classic, sadly gendered thermostat experience joke. So some people are going to find 60 degrees downright chilly in October because it's likely their capillaries are still closer to the top of their skin and haven't burrowed down yet. But a 40 degree day in February, some people clearly think that's t-shirt weather. And I've seen them on my dog walks.
Oh, yes. My son is one of them. 100%. He'll wear a hoodie, but he's wearing shorts all winter long. And that's just
and
how
you know,
it is.
That might be because their capillaries have already descended and they're good. They've been burrowing, whatever.
They're youthful, so they're more limber. Their capillaries are like full of verve and pep, and mine are just like, we're too tired to move south again.
Oh, I can relate to that one.
Yes.
Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Yale News. It's titled, Visual Clutter Alters Information Flow in the Brain.
Okay.
Oh, wow. They did the study to confirm that.
Yeah, yeah. Which I don't keep the most clean of desks or office space, but this was motivating me a little bit because, lately, I've been wondering, like, you know, is all the stuff actually wearing on my brain in the background? Or, like, when I'm trying to sit back and think, am I actually noticing all of the stuff that's just, like, piled up on my desk, random trinkets, blah, blah, blah? Yep. And the answer is probably scientifically yes now. So, very tragic. But in a new study published in the journal Neuron, Yale researchers show that this clutter alters how information flows in the brain, as does the precise location of that clutter within the wider field of vision. Anirvan Nandi, an assistant professor of neuroscience at Yale School of Medicine and co-senior author of the study, says, prior research has shown that visual clutter has an effect on the target of your perception and to different degrees depending on where that clutter is with respect to where you're currently looking. So, for example, if I'm asked to read the word cat out of the corner of my eye, the letter T will have a much greater effect than the letter C, even though C and T are equidistant from A. This phenomenon is called visual crowding, and it's why we can't read out of the corner of our eyes, no matter how hard we try, and why we have a hard time identifying objects when they're located among the clutter at the edge of our vision. For this new study, researchers set out to determine what happens in the brain when this visual clutter is present. So to do so, they trained macaque monkeys, a species whose visual systems and abilities are most similar to humans, to fixate on the center of a screen while visual stimuli were presented in and outside of their receptive fields. The researchers found that the specific location of this clutter within the monkey's visual field didn't have much of an effect on how information was passed between neurons in the primary visual cortex. It did, however, affect how efficiently that information flowed.
The monkeys couldn't read out of the corner of their eye either.
Right. Yeah, yeah. They got a doubly difficult task in front of them. So the researchers also uncovered a general property of the visual cortex that was not previously known. There are several brain areas involved in seeing and recognizing an object, and information is passed through those regions in a particular order. What the researchers found in the new study was that there are also subunits within these larger areas that are doing their own computations and relaying some, but not all, of that information to other subunits. The finding bridges a disconnect that had existed between different fields studying vision. The researchers are now interested in how clutter might affect information processing and how attention influences this system. When you're driving, for instance, you may be looking at the car in front of you, but your attention could be focused on a car in the next lane as you try to determine if they're about to merge. Jody asks, how does that attention compensate for the fact that while you don't have the best resolution information, you're still able to perceive that attended part of the visual space much better than where you're actually looking? How does this attention influence information flow in the cortex? That's what we want to explore.
So you know who's been studying this kind of independently for a few decades now is the U.S. Air Force.
Oh, yeah, like the HUD and what's in your field of vision.
And how much information they have to garner within a split second is all in their periphery. It's pretty remarkable. But also, the amount of training it takes to be able to do that is insane.
It seems to also just come down to focus. Like, I'm very curious as to how they define clutter in this study.
Right. Well, like, is it better to have four screens on your computer showing you everything at once? Or is it better to just have the one where you have to flip back and forth, but you don't have this constant awareness of all the material, you know?
Right. And do I have all the Funko bobbleheads in my room?
Right.
Or just like one?
Well, yeah. I mean, what you could do is take your Funko Pops and arrange them into a big arrow that points back at your computer screen. So it's like, no, flow this way. Go keep your eyes on your work.
They're all arranged in little cubicles doing work of their own to remind you what you're supposed to be doing.
Yes. All my tiny little employees perfectly arranged.
I've never felt more like Elon Musk in this moment. Okay, I'm done.
Oh, boy. Next link?
Next link.
Well, we'll stay on brain processing and eye processing. This is from The Guardian. Human brain can process certain sentences in a, quote, blink of an eye. So whether it's a news headline or a text message, modern humans are inundated with short pieces of text. Now researchers say they've unpacked how we get the gist in just a single glance. Professor Linnea Palkkanen, co-author of the study from New York University, said most theories of language processing assume words are understood one by one in sequence before combining to yield the meaning of the whole sentence. Quote, from this perspective, at a glance, language processing really shouldn't work since there's just not enough time for all the sequential processing of words and their combination into larger representation. However, the research reveals we can detect certain sentence structures in as little as 125 milliseconds. That's similar to a blink of an eye.
Oof.
We don't know yet exactly how this ultra-fast structure detection is possible, but the general hypothesis is that when something you perceive fits really well with what you already know, in this case, we're talking about knowledge of grammar, this top-down knowledge can help you identify the stimulus really fast. So I'm sure you've all seen those, you read that first sentence wrong memes,
yeah,
kind of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is kind of on that general finding and how quickly we discern that. So the team says the findings suggest parallels with the way in which we perceive visual scenes, noting the results could have practical uses for the designers of digital media, as well as advertisers, designers of road signs, or other nefarious actors. So here's how the experiment went down. They used a non-invasive scanning device to measure the brain's activity of 36 participants. Each participant was presented with a three-word starting sentence that flashed up for 300 milliseconds, followed by a second sentence that was either identical or different by one word. So the results reveal participants made faster and more accurate judgments on whether the sentences matched when they contained a subject-verbed object, for example, nurses clean wounds, than when they contained a list of nouns such as hearts, lungs, livers.
Huh. Like instead of like, here is a data set, here's an actual sentence that you can extract mm-hmm. meaning from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you turn it into the implausible, like wounds clean nurses, that one took us longer. Like that gave us what we call an agreement error. Mm-hmm. Though, honestly, wounds clean nurses, you can make sense of if you go deep.
Well, and this is kind of the flip side of how Duolingo works, where we've talked about before, they use really weird sentences,
mm-hmm.
very specifically because it makes your brain stop for a second and go, wait, what?
It's just crazy that you're seeing that within 150 milliseconds.
right.
I think that story in your brain.
The very fact that we can do it faster is why it's harder to remember later. It takes us an extra second, which is why it sticks more in the brain later on. I think these totally line up with each other.
Yeah. Now, the authors did note they focused on English, adding that rapid at-glance comprehension may rely on other features in different languages. So I'm curious what it would look like with kanji or dyslexics like myself and how they would respond to that. Because 36 isn't a whole lot, right? I'm sure there wasn't a dyslexic in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it depends on the grammar that you grew up with. Because like,
right.
Side note, but this is an entirely different study. They did some studies on African-American vernacular where mm-hmm. the idea of Cookie Monster eats cookies and the construction who be eating cookies, children who were raised with that grammar, if you show them a picture of Cookie Monster standing there and Elmo eating cookies, some of the toddlers, if they asked who be eating cookies, they'll still say Cookie Monster because they understand that to be a more general state as opposed to who is currently eating cookies right now. And kids as young as like 2 get that if that's what they've been exposed to, as opposed to children who hadn't been exposed to that grammar. They're like, no, clearly Elmo is the one eating cookies. Mm-hmm. So I think that would also affect how you mm-hmm. chunk certain things if you're seeing phrases with grammar that you're used to versus not used to. Anyway.
Yeah. At the speed of 150 milliseconds. Again, that's the remarkable part for me. It's just like, wow, the brain. We still got a lot to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I definitely had some confirmation bias going on when I chose this next article, but that doesn't necessarily make it any less true. So this is from SciPost.org, and it's called A Unique Event in Japan Gave Scientists Unprecedented Insight into Gaming's Mental Health Effects.
Oh.
So obviously, this is a topic that's been debated for a long time. Are games good for us or not? And there are definitely a lot of people who are still really convinced that gaming is a bad influence, even though most recent studies have shown the opposite. And one of the reasons that anti-gamers, so to speak, want to disregard those studies is that there are a ton of variables at play when you're looking at mental health and lifestyle. And gamers are a self-selected group of people, so even when you do show a definitive correlation, it's impossible to say whether games affect your mental health or your mental health simply causes you to seek out gaming.
Mm-hmm.
But a unique event, as the headline calls it, has allowed researchers to actually do a large-scale randomized trial of gaming. So what happened was the new PlayStation 5 console was released in Japan in November of 2020. But because of the pandemic, people couldn't do the standard camp outside the store for 3 weeks kind of thing to be the first in line. On top of that, the pandemic caused supply chain issues and a massively increased demand for at-home entertainment, which affected even established consoles like the Nintendo Switch, whose sales more than doubled in 2020 compared to 2019. And because of all this, retailers in Japan resorted to a lottery system to determine who was going to get the limited number of Switches and PS5s available, which means you now have a large group of people who all wanted gaming consoles and a randomized subset who actually got them. So, the researchers at Nihon University conducted 5 rounds of online surveys between December 2020 and March of 2022, collecting data from almost 98,000 individuals between the ages of 10 and 69 all across Japan. They measured psychological distress and life satisfaction through well-known scales called K6 and SWLS, and ran lots of fun things like multivariate regression, propensity score matching, and instrumental variable methods with the data. And the end result was absolutely clear. Having a PS5 during the pandemic reduced psychological distress by 0.1 standard deviations, and having a Nintendo Switch reduced it by 0.2 standard deviations.
Wow.
Which admittedly isn't huge, but given the sample size, that's pretty reliable, and it's definitely not negative.
Unless you own an Xbox, then that
changes. They didn't study
Xboxes
at all. But honestly, like, small numbers or not, if I'm Nintendo, the press release I get out of all that is the Switch is twice as good as a PlayStation for your mental health. Mm-hmm. Just my tip for them. Now, there are, of course, some caveats with this. First off, the mental health benefits plateau at about 3 hours of gaming per day. They don't go down if you play for longer than that, but they don't go up anymore either. Also, that 0.1 and 0.2 benefit were an average across the entire sample group. When they broke the demographics down, they found that the Switch was actually even more beneficial to younger players, while the PlayStation beat the Switch when it came to older gamers. They also found that hardcore gamers who played more often and with more intensity, whatever that means, showed greater benefits from owning a PS5, while casual gamers got more out of owning a Switch. The researchers also note that the pandemic itself is a confounding factor, because while it did help in making sure that everyone in the study was experiencing a certain baseline of anxiety, it may also mean that these benefits don't translate to the average anxieties of normal life and may really only be useful in times of significant stress. Another factor they weren't able to examine is what the gaming was a substitute for. Because, for example, during the pandemic, the only alternative might have been sitting and staring at the wall, while during normal times, someone might be choosing to play games instead of socializing or exercising, which might bring its own negative effects. So they're being really upfront here about what they know and what they don't. But at the end of the day, if you're looking at just anxiety and mental health, there is no question that console gaming in moderation is beneficial. Like I said, Xbox and PC, that's for degenerates. They don't know.
Yeah. And what games did they test? What kind of games?
Yeah. Well, that was the thing, is the participants got to choose their own stuff. So, there's also an element of like, well, yeah, if you get to pick the thing you want to do, you're going to be happier. Like, that just sort of goes for all people, I think.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, let's talk about too much of a good thing with exercise, even from ZocaloPublicSquare.com. We need to talk about America's earliest sports influencers. Any guesses?
Baseball players in the 1900s.
Speedwalking.
Oh, my gosh. You're not actually supposed to guess it, Bradley.
I was making a joke.
I know you were. And that's what makes this so amazing. Y'all, they called it pedestrianism. I'm for real about this. And if you go to the article, you will be greeted above the fold with a beautiful black and white illustration of a man holding some kind of like baton, maybe even a sword, with like full boots, that pirate blouse from the Seinfeld episode, with like this intent look on his face, like, I am walking. And there are raised platforms to his sides of well-dressed gentlemen and ladies watching.
Spectator pedestrianism. That's amazing.
Yeah, and part of the reason that Zocalo Public Square is looking at this is because I guess walking has kind of hit its influencer era on social media. There are a lot of videos of it. I don't know, but you can find videos of people doing it silently or collectively.
I think they're including it in the X Games next year.
No.
Well, let's
okay, sorry, I jumped ahead.
Yeah. You're not allowed to be psychic on this podcast, please. Okay.
Not unless we can scientifically verify.
That's right. But this isn't the first time a diverse group of influencers has widened the scope for walking. So it began, at least in America, with a fateful bet, because all good American stories do.
Right.
In 1860, the door-to-door bookseller Edward Payson Weston wagered a friend that Abraham Lincoln would lose the upcoming presidential election. Now, if Lincoln were to win, Weston declared, he would walk the 478 miles from his home in Boston to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. And he would do so in under 10 days.
That's a lot of walking.
Oh, yeah. So after Lincoln won, Weston set out to make good on his promise. He publicized his itinerary in local papers along the eastern seaboard. People waited for hours in the cold to watch him pass through their towns. There was even a run-in with a debt collector, which left Weston 4 hours and 12 minutes short of his goal. Because of that, Lincoln, who had been following his progress along with the rest of the freaking country, he was still so impressed by the feat, he offered to pay the latecomer's fare home. So let's fast forward a little bit, because Zocalo Public Square glosses over a huge chunk of history with this phrase. Following the Civil War.
Right. Later, just a little side story there.
But once all that was kind of settling down, Weston took his walking show on the road. And listen, thousands of spectators lined up to buy tickets and even place bets on whether he could beat the clock. Now, walking was not a popular form of exercise in America when Weston began staging these exhibitions, but he and the competitors who rose up to challenge him spread pedestrian fever among the public. The New York Times op-ed, always to weigh in on a trend, in 1878, they published a plea for pedestrianism. The op-ed supplied readers with a sample walk they could do around Staten Island. Recommendations on what to eat, including one example, a sandwich and some hard-boiled eggs in your pocket.
Pocket eggs.
And even how to prepare for such a walk. Quote, those not accustomed to much walking ought to practice it moderately during the week before marching a whole day in the country. Now, celebrity at the time, this had long been reserved only for royals or maybe a few political figures. Celebrity was starting to expand at this time, which meant that pedestrians, or peds, as they were called at the time, they started to gain real influence as some of the country's first mass market stars. They used their platform to promote not just the sport, but also everything from shoe brands to trading cards. They were even the first to sell advertising space on their competition outfits.
Huh. Ah, like little NASCAR guys, but on foot.
Well, you know, and it makes sense. You're going to have more time to actually see it.
Right.
But one of the reasons that pedestrianism resonated with so many is that these athletes took an activity that was relatable and pushed it to the extreme. And so the result struck people as, see if this sounds familiar, personal, genuine. We might even call it today authentic, right? Mm-hmm. Now, professional walkers reflected an array of Americans too. These walking matches were largely unregulated, so there were no rules saying that certain groups could not even compete, which is why one of Weston's greatest rivals was one Daniel O'Leary, an Irish immigrant who became champion pedestrian of the world in 1875 after defeating Weston in a 6-day race.
Well, hold on. I'm going to assume there's still some rules, like no women and nobody who's not white.
Are you just going to read my article for me, Bradley? Because I could just hand it over to you.
Sorry.
Oh my gosh. So, okay, let's just finish with Mr. O'Leary first. He became champion pedestrian of the world. And because of that, he took multiple athletes under his wing, including a Frank Hart, who was born Fred Hitchborn, a Haitian immigrant, who went on to become the sport's great star and winner of the second ever O'Leary belt in 1880. He earned over 21,000 total, which at the time, it's about 250,000 in today's dollars. Not something to sneeze at.
Yeah.
And because Bradley gave me the segue, women pedestriennes, that spelling was on purpose, They also made an impact on the sport. Now, at a time when conventional science held that strenuous athletic activity would do lasting harm to female bodies.
Their wombs are just going to fall out. You can't even, like...
Literally, they warned that it would affect their ability to reproduce. So, yeah!
I'm sure. Yeah.
But that's what made athletes like the English woman, Ada Anderson, so powerful as a counterexample, showing what sportswomen were capable of. And she put it in her own words as saying, "It is good for women to see how much a woman can endure," which is a little find strength in your abuse. I don't know. There's something off about that for me.
I mean, it's also walking.
Yeah. Like, it's not... Yes. And not only that, because it's still late 1800s, there was obviously a dark side in particular to women's pedestrianism. And this is because, in large part, the sport was promoted mostly and organized by men, including, if you can believe it, one of P.T. Barnum's own PR people. So a majority of women came to professional walking out of desperation to escape poverty or abusive relationships, right? And in doing so, they would push their bodies to the limit. So they were doing what men were doing, these 24-hour walks, 100-mile walks, but they also had to layer in even more extreme stunts, like walking 3,000 quarter miles over the course of 3,000 quarter hours.
Right, in a 75-pound petticoat.
Pretty much, right, yeah. Right. And not only that, women would walk in hard-soled shoes, in part because a lot of their spectators were actually saboteurs, and they would throw rocks, tacks, glass on the track. Wow. Remember, because they were also betting on this unregulated sport in the hopes of, you know, fixing a race outcome. So that same laissez-faire setup that allowed the sport to evolve so organically, it's also what led it to becoming synonymous with exploitation and scandal. It saw race fixing, early steroid use. It even saw an extortion attempt that ended with a manager's suicide. So once bicycle racing in the 1880s started getting big, the public moved on and pedestrianism faded into a historical footnote. But, you know, don't poo-poo the value of a really good walk. It's a great way to burn off a temper. It's a great way to not look at a screen if you can leave it at home for 10 minutes.
I mean, I can walk and look at a screen, y'all. I'm not uncoordinated like that.
I see a lot of people trying these days.
Yeah.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Scientific American, and it's titled, "Anyone Can Learn Echolocation in Just 10 Weeks, and It Remodels Your Brain."
Wow.
I could be a dolphin?
Yeah, or a bat, you know, whatever suits your vibe. And I remember seeing this documentary about this kid who was born blind or went blind at a young age, I forget, but he literally would make clicking sounds and could echolocate, and he basically like taught himself. Wow. And this was over a decade ago, and I thought it was just like some really crazy talent that only he could do because of like different brains, something like that. But apparently, you just gotta try it. Like,
right.
You just
anybody
learn
can
how
it.
To do it. Yeah,
that's awesome.
So human echolocation has at times allowed people to ride bikes or play basketball despite being completely blind from a very young age. These echolocators typically perceive their environment by clicking sharply with their tongues and listening to differences in the sounds reflected off objects. Brain imaging studies reveal that expert echolocators display responses to sound in their brain's primary visual region, and researchers have speculated that long-term input deprivation could lead to visual regions being repurposed. Laura Thaler, a neuroscientist at Durham University in England, says, "There's been this strong tradition to think of the blind brain as different, that it's necessary to have gone through that sensory loss to have this neuroplasticity." Thaler co-led a 2021 study showing that both blind and sighted people could learn echolocation with just 10 weeks of training. Both blind and sighted people displayed responses to echoes in their visual cortex, a finding that challenges the belief that primary sensory regions are wholly sense-specific. The researchers trained 14 sighted and 12 blind people for between 2 and 3 hours twice a week over 10 weeks, which is really not that much.
Yeah, it's not even really 10 weeks. It's 10 weeks, but only twice a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, 2 to 3 hours is quite a bit, but to learn to echolocate, pretty sick. So they started by teaching participants to produce mouth clicks, then trained them on 3 tasks. The first 2 involved judging the size or orientation of objects. The 3rd involved navigating virtual mazes, which participants moved through with the help of simulated click plus echo sounds tied to their positions. During brain scans before and after training, participants also performed a task that involved recognizing mazes with and without click echoes. After training, both groups showed increased auditory cortex activation in response to sound in general, as well as higher gray matter density in auditory areas. Most surprisingly, after training, both blind and sighted participants also showed visual cortex activation in response to audible echoes. She suspects that rather than just processing visual data, this brain area takes in information from varied senses that aid spatial understanding.
Hmm.
A follow-up survey found that 83% of blind participants who had learned echolocation reported improvements in independence and well-being. The researchers are working on disseminating the training more widely, Thaler says. It's a powerful sensory tool for people with vision impairments. So, short, but really cool. And it's also making me think that if I ever wanted to echolocate, I should probably also reduce the clutter so there's less auditory clutter, so it's cleaner. Yeah.
One of the things I tell students, because I teach audio engineering, is they can't hear some of the things that we can hear. And mostly I tell them by the end that you're done with it, you'll be listening to music differently. You'll be focusing on different things. Kind of like this, right? Where you're closing your eyes, you're focusing on something completely different. And it'll ruin music for them forever.
Right, exactly. And this will ruin cityscapes because now you'll know what they sound like as you're walking by. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include a new volcanic era, the U.S. Empire was built on bird dung, and we are living in a golden age of apples. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.